This is the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 31st of January 2018. Ken Freeland and Cheryl Curtis facilitating, Craig McKee secretary. Do you want to do the roll, Craig?
Yeah, sure. I'll just read who I have. Barbara Honegger, Barry Zwicker, Barton Bruce, Ken Jenkins, Lynn Bradbury, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, David Cole, Frank Tolopko, Gerald Pichenik, and I've also got James Hufford, although I didn't see him come up on the thing there.
I am here.
Oh, there he is. Okay. Yeah. I see you now. I have Peter Ketchum, Tim Michael, Xander Arena, and Pat O'Connell. Did I miss anyone?
Mike Cook. I'm down in Australia, Mike.
I got you, Mike.
Oh, I didn't hear. Thanks.
Yeah.
Did you get me, Mike? Hello?
Sorry? Yeah?
David Palmer down in Australia.
Oh, yes. Hi, David.
Hi, Mike.
Glad you could make it. David
Who's this?
David, yeah.
David what?
His name's David Palmer. I'll let him introduce himself.
Oh, yeah.
David, welcome.
Yeah, what time is it in Australia?
9 o'clock Friday morning.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
My. Okay. All right, so having done the roll call, then we will move on to approval of the minutes from the previous teleconference as circulated by Craig and reposted on the draft agenda. Any objections to approving the minutes, or anybody need to amend the minutes before we go forward? Hearing no amendments offered, then we will take the minutes for approved and move on to consideration of tonight's draft agenda. Any amendments to the agenda, the draft agenda?
Yeah, this is Wayne.
Wayne, go ahead.
I'd like to add at the end a maybe 5-minute overview of a no bases or closing U.S. bases conference that was held in Baltimore a couple of weeks ago.
Okay. Any objections to giving Wayne 5 minutes at the end of the agenda for discussion of UFO conference? Okay, hearing none, then we will add that to the agenda. Any other amendments to the agenda? All right, then I'll take the draft agenda as amended, as approved, and see if I can just bring it up here on my little computer. Okay, so the first item on our agenda tonight is Wayne Kosky telling us his response to questions regarding the radar and approach caps. Purportedly taken on 9/11 at the Pentagon. So, Wayne, the floor is yours. Go ahead.
All right. Well, thanks. I'm going to try to go through this pretty quickly. Keep it within 15 minutes. Included in the agenda was a draft PowerPoint that you could download. You can go to. If you didn't get to it, you can go to hopeoutloud.org, www.hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon, and it'll be the top item there. So the purpose of this presentation was to review the flight path near the impact area so that because there were some questions raised about previous presentations saying how things didn't quite line up. And so I needed to go take a look at this. Because it was criticized as being inaccurate, the paths were shown. Previous presentations were not perfectly in sync with each other, so I had to take the time to go back and account for the flight left bank that was described in many witnesses and make everything kind of align. So I've done that. So in this presentation, I'll be describing the entire approach path from some miles out. We'll be looking at the radar approaching the Arlington area. Include the spiral descent, the impossibility of the north of Sitko aberration, a little how do you make that little dance at the end if it did go north of Sitco? And how it aligns with the shadow captured in the Sitco video, the notched tree near Washington Boulevard, Lloyd England streetlights, and the final segment impacting the trailer and retaining walls. So moving on to slide, I guess five now. Multiple radar tracking stations corroborated a flight path towards the Pentagon. There's a tight right bank that continued until a place called About Bailey's Crossing, routes 7 and 244, and some can go on mute over there. Some of the dishes. About 5 miles from the Pentagon, the Dulles flight controllers thought it was a military plane due to the 14,000-foot radius at a turn at 350 miles an hour, not something they've seen typically. They thought it was a military. And then it was followed by a slight left bank for the final 2 miles. The plane approach was seen by witnesses, and it was identified as being south of the Sheridan Hotel, north of the Virginia Department of Transfer, Transportation Tower, and along traveling along Columbia Pike. The place was low, and in this area, as reported by Edward Pake, Terry Morin, who was CIT with interviewees, Don Vignola, Tim Timmerman, Steve Storty, who were in Pentagon City, and Deb Onluff, who was in the Sheridan and saw it go by her. Slide 7. Witnesses near the Pentagon talk of a left bank or a left wing down. The path shown reflects this right bank, big circle, followed by a slight left bank as it approaches the actual Pentagon. A frequently quoted north of Sitco path is shown for comparison. It requires effectively a 2,000-foot radius turn at 500 miles an hour, which would create 9 or 10 G-forces if it were to go zooming quick to the left over the Navy Annex to the right, past the to the north of the Sitco and crashing into the building or doing anything. Slide 8 is just a review of the data that I got for the Pentagon. The slide 9 shows how this was plotted on Google Maps. You can see that there's a fair amount of diversity. There isn't quite a straight path through all this. There's many different dots, but it shows the route. That's slide 9. Slide 10 zooms in. We also point out a place called 1400 South Barton, which is where Tom Trapezio's he was sitting on his deck when the plane flew over him at treetop level or 300 feet. It turns out it was probably more like 600 feet, but who can tell distances that quickly? So slide 11 kind of zooms in. It shows where the final couple of miles, and you can see where 1400 South Barton is. The flight path goes just about above it. And slide 12 actually is kind of a repeat, it looks like. Slide 13. Oh yeah, the slide 12 and 13 are a pair because they are scaled to be the same. Slide 13 is from the flight data recorder. I typically don't use the flight data recorder because there's no one on this call that's going to believe anything that the flight data recorder is. So I've just included it here because it is consistent with the other data that we've seen. And it records in the area of Tom Trapezio's house an altitude of 786 feet, and he's at 200, so it's about 600 feet above his house. Slide 14 just basically shows what a straight line would look like. There's a slight left bank in the flight data recorder. It's not as strong as I actually drew, but that's what it is. Slide 15 shows the same radar approach, and at the very end, it shows a 2,000-foot little diversion there around the Sitco station, which would create a 9 G-force acceleration. Slide 16 is the same thing. Just in some more detail. Next, a bunch of slides I'm not really going to go through very much. They do talk about the number of witnesses, talking about how the left wing was down. We've got Albert Hemphill, We've got Marianne Owens on slide 19, Jack Singleton, who may or may not have actually been a witness, but this is what he was told. Slide 21 is Steve Sorty. 22 is Steve Anderson. Madeline Zackheim, who was on Columbia Pike, effectively near the VDOT tower, and her account placed the plane within inches of the roof of a small building with the left wing tilted down. So we have Penny Inglis. So there's witnesses there that talk about a slight left bank. In slide 26, we get into the last mile. I've drawn it as close to scale as I can, putting the plane passing where the CIT witnesses and others had said that the plane had gone by. I want to point out the Sitco station, which is in red, and the tree with a notch, which is a green arrow, a green circle. We're going to see that in a few moments. Slide 27 is the tree that's going to that has a notch in it. This is 2009, so it's had 8 years to grow out. But we'll see the pictures of the day. Slide 28 is the light pole for the light pole number two, which we'll touch on. Going back to slide 29, kind of zoomed into the last half mile. We're going to take a closer look at this slide. So we're going to go and look at the security camera. The released videos had a couple that were related to the Pentagon, the two security cameras. We had the DoubleTree and the Sitco security camera. Slide 32 is the location of the Sitco in relationship to the crashed-in wall. Slide 33 shows where the Sitco camera, where the shadow would have been for the plane that as it passed the Sitco station along this exact same path. And I've tried to use the exact same drawing in all these pictures here, so the resolution gets worse as you get zoomed in a little bit. So shows the direction of the sunlight and the field of view. Slide 34 and 35 are, if you look at them, you'll see the shadow. And then in slide 35, the shadow is gone. The white space in the middle, as I've shown in previous presentations, is caused by some low shrubbery that was there. You can see that in that kind of that first overview of the Pentagon there. The tree notch on slide 37, there's a tree just before the first light pole number one that had a notch that was clearly identifiable. It defines the location of the right engine. It's consistent with the street lamp damage, and the photo shows stripped and cut branches. Slide 38 is an overview, a Jason Ingersoll photo, I believe, showing the tree notch. We're going to kind of zoom in on it on slide 39. You can see it's kind of got this kind of like rounded shape, and it's got some little white images that are kind of white boundary at the top. And as we'll see in the next couple of slides, that's stripped bark from trees. So what would have done that? Something going by very fast. Slide 40 is showing another picture of the same tree. Slide 41 is kind of a zoom in, and you can see that the tree was sheared, and the branches were actually roughly cut. So to show you what it looks like, to prove that this was, in fact, a 9/11 event, so we have slide 42, which is a picture taken from the Sitco station. Slide 43 zooms in on that particular tree, and you can see it's kind of flat-topped, maybe even a little bit of rounded like the other pictures showed. Slide 44 is a picture taken on May 1st, year 2000, 13 or 14 months earlier. And you can see the tree in the background, and if you zoom in, you can see it's not, slide 45 shows it's not flat. It's still kind of bushy at the top. So it doesn't have a same shape, and the other ones would have the characteristics of the top having been sheared off by something going by. Jonathan Cole had noted that the speed of his brush hog that cuts tree brush is probably rotating at about 150 miles an hour when it cuts the trees and with a brush hog. Slide 47, we're going to touch on Lloyd's taxicab. I've gone through this in a previous presentation. I don't need to go through it too much here. Slide 48 shows the different pieces of the poles, the mast pole, the lamp, the lower arm. Slide 49 shows where they are in conjunction with the tree with the notch. It's got lamp post number one and lamp post two. Slide 50 shows the location of the large mast and some of the other pieces. Mast 2 was in the previous diagram 49 was not fully impacted. It was knocked, and of course, as you saw, as you recall, it was not severed like lamppost number 1 was. It was, in fact, bent and knocked to the side, but not severed. So something much less massive or powerful or rigid hit it. So it looked like it was the wingtip of the left wing. Slide 51 kind of zooms in on those parts. Slide 52 shows where the parts are. Slide 53 shows lamp post number 2 laying as it's been bent, but not severed. The north end of the Pentagon terminus of the flight path begins on slide 55, highlights the retaining wall, the diesel generator, and the tree at column 16. Slide 56 is something you've seen before. It shows the plane approaching the retaining wall and the diesel generator. 57 shows where the impact with the diesel generator would have been. 58 shows the impact with the retaining wall. Slide 59 shows the retaining wall that has been damaged and exactly the right number of feet apart. Slide 60, you see the diesel generator trailer has been kind of bashed in and rotated and moved forward. So the conclusion is that the flight path from radar to the Pentagon is consistent with the observed data. The radar is consistent with Trapezio's observation. Location between the Sheridan and VDOT is confirmed. The shadow on the Citgo security camera is consistent. The tree notch confirms the right engine location. The severed lamp post number 1 means the impact by the wing spar. The bent lamp post number 2 verifies it was hit by the extremity of the left wing. The impacted diesel generator indicates the location of the right engine as it approaches the building. And the impacted retaining wall indicates the location of the left engine. The slight bank, left bank to the left in the final 2 miles has been ignored when discussing the final approach, and ignoring the left bank leads to misunderstandings, and including the left bank puts it all into focus. That's what I have. There's an appendix that goes through Lagasse's who's the basis for the Bet My Life left turn over the Citgo station. And I have to point out that Robert Tercio stands out and points in the opposite direction. And, you know,
okay,
so it's not me saying it's
okay.
Yeah, we're okay, I'm done.
We're out of time. Okay.
Okay, very good.
Thank you so much for your keeping it to roughly 15 minutes. And since this was a response to Craig, I think it's only fair to allow Craig to speak first, but we will go into Q&A mode. So if you want to make a comment or ask a question regarding what you've just heard, once we go into Q&A mode, you will be able to do so by pressing star 6. It should put you in the queue, okay? But, Craig, I assume you're not muted, so you...
I'm unmuted now, yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
So, did you want me to go ahead?
Yes, please.
Okay. First of all, I do want to make one point that this presentation is much more than a an answering of questions I raised in October. It's just the beginning of the presentation addresses the issue of the flight path, and the all the rest of it really was had nothing to do with questions from me. So I just wanted to be clear about the fact that this most of the presentation has nothing to do with my questions. In fact, a fair amount of it is stuff that we have already heard about before. I do want to say that I think I'm glad to at least see that Wayne has acknowledged that the flight path that he presented to us in October is wrong and that he has changed that. And I gather that what he's really saying is that any flight path, I mean, this is a completely different flight path than what we've seen before. So I gather that the ones that we've seen in past presentations are no longer applicable. Now, what I found about the flight path in October, the reason I objected to it immediately, first of all, it went right over the Navy Annex, which was completely incompatible with the damage, and completely different from the official path. What I couldn't figure out after that was how you were going to manage to correct the flight path so that it achieved what you are seem to be seeking to try and achieve, which is to put the flight path north of the VDOT tower so that it can go lower and yet still line up with the damage. The only way I could see is if you had the plane changing direction to some degree. And in fact, that's exactly what you ended up doing. You moved the flight path a bit more south, and you made the flight path more curved so that it can be south of the Navy Annex for most of the way and still kind of you reinforce this left bank thing to sort of account for the fact that when it's going alongside the Navy Annex, it doesn't line up with the damage either. So I want to get into, you have a number of witnesses that you just kind of touch on very quickly to the idea of the left wing dipping. One of those people said that the left wing was drug along the ground, to quote him. That's Steve Anderson from USA Today. So clearly he was wrong about that. Marianne Owens, you quote, and she says the left wing scraped along the helipad. And clearly she's wrong about that as well, because it obviously didn't. You bring back Steve Storti, which is kind of astounding to me, because he was three quarters of a mile away from the Pentagon, and he actually claimed that he could see people moving around inside the plane from that distance. And yet and he also mentions that the plane veered sharply at one point, which is not really consistent with anything. So I'm not sure why you would rely on him to report a slight dip in the left wing from three quarters of a mile away. And Albert Hemphill, who was the subject of a recent article by David Chandler, clearly puts the plane right over the Navy Annex, which is north of the path required to account for the damage. So I'm not really sure. I don't think these witnesses are very strong for you at all. And I want to talk about the William Lagasse really quick. I don't want to go on too long because other people want to ask, but in National Security Alert, which is the interview that is on camera that everybody can look at and they can hear the questions, they can watch how he answers those questions, he clearly points north of the gas station. He points to exactly where he saw the plane, and he describes it, and then he draws it on an aerial photograph. And there's absolutely no question that he's putting the plane north of the gas station. And then you mentioned Robert Tercios as pointing in the opposite direction. I don't know what you're talking about here, because you've got a still of him pointing, but I couldn't even find that still in National Security Alert. But I mean, obviously, it's a real image, but what he's describing there is the plane going over the north corner of the canopy of the gas station. And he's pointing at the canopy, but he says that the right wing went over the northernmost part of the canopy. So he's not disagreeing with Lagasse. He's not fundamentally contradicting Lagasse, as you suggest. In fact, he doesn't put the plane as far north as Lagasse does, but he still puts it north of the official path and north of the Citgo gas station. So anyway, I'm not sure I'm going to I'm not sure I should go on too much longer. I should probably just stop there and just let you respond if you wish.
Okay. Well, thanks Craig for your comments. I think basically we're largely in agreement on a number of things here. I did, as you point out, have to realign the flight paths from my previous presentations to kind of get them all to kind of fit. I had to recognize that there was a slight left the bank that really kind of made the everything come into focus. But the amounts that I had to shift the flight paths were on the order of maybe 10, 20 feet out around the Navy Annex type area. Nothing dramatic. So it's all consistent with what I presented before when I talked about Lloyd's taxicab, the Citgo Shadow. And I've now added the additional detail of the notch in the tree with the various images. So the alignments were more to bring everything into focus than a changing a direction. So, the path that is now presented, which is consistent, does align with the damage, and it hits the right engine, hits the notch of the tree, the right engine hits the diesel generator, the light pole hits to the right of the right engine, the left wing hits to the, or bashes, or nicks the light pole number two. So everything kind of lines up. The reason that I've used all these witnesses is they all say left bank. I haven't found a witness that says right bank. So the preponderance of all the people saying left bank seems to be a consensus that the plane was, if it's doing anything at all besides going flat, it was banking to the left, and that makes everything kind of work. The I guess the last thing about the Lagasse is, while it's in the appendix, the picture is either from National Security Alert or the Pentagon. I think it's the Pentagon, actually. So you might want to look there. But Tercio's pointing over the roof of the Citgo, the canopy of the Citgo station. But Lagasse put the plane 300 feet behind him along the wall. That's where he put it. So it he would have had to be turning around, pointing the opposite direction. So I think I'm pretty sure it's the Pentagon. You can go look there and see Tercio. Since Lagasse bet his life, but Tercio's putting the bullet between his eyes. So I think, I think I've covered most of the points here. So you can ask again, or we can go to the next questioner. Thanks. Over.
Well, a couple of points. I'm not sure what, I haven't looked at Pentagon as opposed to National Security Alert to find this image of him pointing. But I don't really think it matters whether we can get a still image of him pointing. I think what matters is, what is he saying? What is the story that he's describing? And he's very clear about what he's describing, and that is that the plane, the right wing of the plane, went over the left, the north corner of the canopy of the station. He says that very clearly, and throughout the whole interview, he's pointing to the north to describe where the plane went. And he even says that it lifted up before it went over the do not enter sign that's over the highway. So he describes that as well. Now, Lagasse, clearly he has it a little bit farther away, but how you can turn that around so that now the plane is completely behind him, how can you possibly justify that?
Well, I'll just let you take a review the Pentagon video yourself, and the others here can review it themselves. Lagasse puts the plane over the stone wall at the Arlington National Cemetery, 300 feet behind where Tercio is pointing in the opposite direction. So clearly something's not right. And the entire reason for doing this was to show that the plane couldn't get out as far as the Arlington Cemetery wall because it would be creating a 200-foot tight turn at 500 miles an hour, creating the 9.7 Gs that the plane can't handle. That's the whole point for doing it. Even if it went over the Citgo station, you'd have a not quite so sharp or large G value, but it would be far too large, and the plane wouldn't be able to get back over the Pentagon if it did was having coming in that direction. So that's the whole point. Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say nobody is suggesting that the plane flew south of the Navy Annex and then did a sudden swerve to go north of the gas station and then turned bank right to go into the Pentagon. I mean, nobody's saying that. So your G-force thing is you're assuming that you're trying to put together the north of Citgo witnesses with the radar data and saying, well, that can't work. Therefore, the north of Citgo witnesses are wrong. But I mean, what you're implying here about Tercio saying that, you know, something's wrong here because he's where he's pointing. I mean, if you don't even know what it was he was saying when he was pointing, then that's kind of worthless, don't you think? They both put the plane north of the gas station. What could be clearer?
He was pointing above over there, and again, I invite you to go look at the video.
I don't think we're going to resolve this point tonight because apparently it has to do with.
Ken, there is one other point I have to make here. The other CIT witnesses put the plane on the south corner near the Sheridan of the Navy Annex, going over it in that direction, and to turn and hit the Pentagon as they say it did. Unless you want to be one of the flyover, in which case it must have gone off some far away from the Pentagon, it would have had to make a 2,000-foot radius turn, which, as we've discussed when we talked about the pilot for 9/11 Truth, that's what they say, you can't have a Boeing 757 doing a 2,000-foot radius turn, which is what
I think there's agreement on that. I think both of you agree that the north of Citgo cannot be justified according to the Pentagon damage. So let's drop that there. Okay, give others a chance to ask their questions or make their comments. Okay, because we do have several people waiting in the queue, and we'll get to them really directly here. Okay, so the next one is Xander or Elena. Try to make it fairly succinct, please, Xander. We have several people waiting. Go ahead.
Yep. Okay. Wayne, I appreciate this presentation. The tree information is new to me, and I would like to hear from you when you discovered this notch tree. And then I want to point out that the vector from the tree to the building, I'm looking at slide 40, doesn't really appear to reconcile the other stuff that's going on behind the heliport. And I wanted to ask if you, and I still don't see evidence of a 757 in the building, so I'm wondering if you might have some other notion of a different form of aircraft that might have additionally taken the south of Citgo approach. I don't think that the 2,000-foot radius turn is possible. I think this kind of, looking at this tree, man, I'm intrigued. I think that maybe we do have two vehicles in the area, two aircraft. One flying over, one impacting. I don't know. I'm willing to give you that. And I just wanted to hear if you have any thoughts of an additional style or form of aircraft that might have done this, and that's all I got.
Well, thanks, Alexander. First of all, I would direct you to slide 26, which is entitled The Last Mile the Plane Swept. It shows the plane going over the area south of the Sheridan, barely touching the or flying over the Navy Annex, kind of in line with what Terry Moran said. And then you see the circle, which is where the tree is. And from the image on slide 40, I think maybe you said, that showed the notch, this is where the tree actually is, and it's right along the flight path that goes that is validated by the shadow, the notch, the Lloyd England light poles, the diesel generator trailer, and the retaining wall, and then hitting at column 14 or thereabouts. So Everything is really kind of consistent here. I first became aware of this probably about 6 months ago.
We don't need the long and the short on there. The question was basically, you think another aircraft may have been involved?
Everything's perfectly consistent with a single plane flying in this direction.
Okay.
I see no evidence or anything else.
Yeah.
Over.
That's fair. Okay, so try to keep the answers that direct if you possibly can, and we'll go on to Barry's Wicker. Barry.
I wonder if, Wayne, you've heard about Malcolm Gladwell's concept of one thin slice, which is basically that if there's one significant aspect of a story, the whole narrative fails. So in your presentation, there are many thin slices and indeed thick ones. For instance, Lloyd Englund's taxi story does not hold up whatsoever. No wreckage of a large transport category aircraft was ever found in or around the Pentagon. The whole of the Pentagon in no way matches a 757 regarding wings, giant engines, or rudder. The hole in the interior of the Pentagon could not have been made by the aluminum nose of any aircraft. Hanny Hanger could not have piloted such a plane. You mentioned England, but otherwise you didn't mention these other things. So most of your presentation, I have to conclude, is noise. The noise of odd angels dancing on the head of a Pentagon pin. I think it was an exercise in obfuscation, and you've shown yourself immune to counter-argument. I don't have a question. I'm just making that comment.
Well, thank you very much, Barry. But I think what that means is you haven't paid attention to the other presentations that I've made in which I've gone over all the pieces for Lloyd Englund's light poles. All the pieces can be identified in photographs. The locations are where that are consistent with that. There are no thin slices, and if there's any thin slices, it's anything to do with a plane flyover, explosives only. We, of course, went through the wall in two different presentations. The wall was made of just steel tubes bolted together at the ceilings with 3/4-inch rods. That's all it was. So you've not paid attention to these others, and I invite you to go to the website hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon, where I've got the archive of these presentations.
If you just took Lloyd Englund, that's one slice right there.
I'm going to have to ask you to be a little more succinct in your responses, okay? Because we've got three more people that want to talk, and we've got three more presentations, okay? So let's move on, okay?
Thank you.
Peter Ketchum, you're next. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So I have a really basic question. Am I allowed to ask a very basic question about the crash, or does it have to be about the flight path in particular?
Well, the presentation was on the flight path tonight, okay, so it really should pertain to that to some degree. But if you have other questions, I'm sure Wayne would be happy to answer them if you email him. Okay?
I'll keep it down to 33 seconds. So what's your answer? What's your question, Peter?
This is possibly very naive because I haven't spent any time studying it. If a plane crashed, where is the wreckage from the plane? Where are the dead bodies? Where's the luggage? That's my
inside
question.
The answer is real simple. It's inside the building. The misconception that people have is that there's a concrete brick reinforced castle style wall. In fact, it was just steel tubes holding up windows with infill.
I think he's asking where's the evidence. He's asking where's the evidence of it, I believe. Okay, where's the proof that it was inside the building? Okay.
Well, that's a much bigger lift, and I'm not going to answer that in 30 seconds even. So I haven't developed it. I haven't gone through that. I'd have to go make a presentation talking about the interior of the buildings and what's found, and it's a whole lot harder.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Another time.
Okay. So we don't really have enough time for that question. Thank you. Okay, so, all right. Barbara, please keep it succinct and pertinent to the flight path. Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Why didn't that work? Barbara Honegger, you're up. Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear me okay now?
Yes.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. Okay. First off, I hadn't heard it when I was preparing my comment, but I appreciate Xander keeping open the very serious possibility that there were two planes. That's the whole message of Behind the Smoke Curtain, which I hope that Peter Ketchum watches on YouTube. And I have an email to everybody on the 9/11 teleconference call. I've made a major discovery. And that is that two of the very critical Citizens Investigation Team witnesses, CIT witnesses, William Middleton and Sean Boger. Sean Boger was in the air traffic controller tower on top of the heliport firehouse, significantly to the left or north of even the helipad. So we're talking 200 feet further to the left or north from the alleged impact point by the official story. Both Sean Boger and William Middleton explicitly in words place the final approach of the plane, which is what really matters, just before the wall at what they call the old firehouse. And I've just sent you a photograph from 8,000 of the old firehouse, and you will see that the air traffic controller tower on top of the old firehouse, which had been destroyed and removed before 9/11, is effectively just off the wall opposite the center of the H of the helipad. You're talking at least 100 feet further to the left or north, just beyond the helipad, where all that plane debris that's like confetti and some, quite a few middle-sized pieces and some large pieces, that's where all those pieces are. So we're talking about at least 100 to 120 feet after north along the wall from the alleged impact point at column 14 that Wayne supports. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara.
Well, thanks, Barbara. I'll point out that Sean Boger actually says he, in his Center for Military History, says, and I'm watching the plane go all the way into the building. So once it went into the building, it exploded. And once it exploded, I hit the floor and covered my head. So, you know, the location of the old tower is relatively consistent with any of this discussion, because it was...
No, it's not. No, area. It's at least 100 to 120 feet further to the left or north. And there are legion other reasons for knowing, not just believing, that there was an early plane that was destroyed somehow before hitting the wall, that appeared to hit the wall from certain vantage points, right, both vantage points, at 9:32 and 30 seconds, over 5 minutes before Flight 77, or whatever plane came in at the path that you're describing, Wayne, even got close to Washington, D.C.
Okay, thanks. Next question.
Yep. Thank you, Barbara. And lastly, Frank Talocco. Go ahead, Frank. Please keep it brief.
Frank here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi, Frank.
Frank.
Okay, how you doing? I have a statement here. I've been following these discussions, for the past year or more with more or less taking things in rather than adding to it. I'm referring everybody here to slide 26, which has the Sheraton, the Navy Annex, and Citgo Station. I don't know, whoever has it, call it up, because then it'll refer to what I'm saying. What I did was, and many people will remember that the 10th anniversary, the Washington, D.C. group, along with some of us from the Northeast, put on a weekend conference there about 9/11, and it was great that we were overlooking the Pentagon. But what was interesting, I went back to my notes, and what happened is when we were checking in, and Cheryl was there, on Friday evening, a couple of the younger people there, and they were in their 30s, were asking what we were there for, and we explained it. He says, oh, yeah, we were here. There's some plane went over the Sheraton and clipped some of the antennas off. We don't know where the heck the plane went, but that's what everybody was saying, that it had come right over the Sheraton, which is to the north of where this suggested flight path is. Now, this is hearsay because I never got their names, etc., and you just have to trust that that's in fact what they said. But if in fact true, that would indicate that it was to the north of the Citgo Station, and it wasn't as described here on slide 26.
Okay.
So, okay, Frank, thanks. I was there, too, and I heard the same stories. I asked for the videos. I asked for more information, and no one gave me any. So the again, looking at all the damage path, looking at all the witnesses that have made statements, some of which have been recorded by the CIT. The plane went to the south of the Sheridan Station, north of the VDOT Towers, along the Navy Annex, clipped the notch in the tree, left the shadow, caught in the security camera at the CITGO, hit the light poles, hit the diesel generator trailer, hit the retaining wall, all in a straight line, aligns roughly adequately with the radar paths. So, you know, hearsay is a great place to begin asking questions, but it doesn't seem to hold up in light of all this other material that puts a single plane going down this path, hitting this stuff, leaving this trail of witnesses, and going into the Pentagon. So that's all, I guess.
All right. Thank you, Wayne. Thank you, Frank. And so now we are done with this particular issue for today, and we will move on to our second agenda item. A man that really knows how to keep his time to a dead minimum so far. Darrell Pacek will give us a brief update on the Robert Mueller story. So go ahead, Darrell. You're up. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. And I will hold on to my end of the keeping it short. So I think the best way to start is to refer back to Martin Luther King, August 16th, 1967, in a speech, Where Do We Go From Here?, which is certainly the case for 9/11 people and all of us. He said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." And so I would say, in the case of Robert Mueller, and in the case of 9/11, and the other cases that we brought, I brought up in the last couple calls, that is, the case of Lyndon LaRouche with Mueller, the case of 9/11 with Mueller, and now the case of the Trump case with Mueller. Because what Dr. King said is true, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, I would say right about now the deep state, as you call it, 9/11 and other deep state crimes, the deep state is in deep shit. They got doo-doo up to their faces. And I'll just give you a couple of references and then stop. Just two days ago, on the 29th, the prestigious Washington, D.C., The Hill, brought back the case of Robert Mueller and 9/11 in a feature article titled "Robert Mueller's Forgotten Surveillance Crime Spree." And it refers to Colleen Rowley and other people warning FBI about 9/11 and Mueller totally ignoring them and then using 9/11 to set up surveillance to violate the Constitution, the Patriot Act, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the guy is a no good damn liar, first class liar. So that came out just 2 days ago in The Hill. And on Saturday, I was on a Armenian-American Broadcasting International broadcast with people know Ray McGovern. And I think Barbara may have been at a presentation that Ray McGovern and Bill Binney did in New York back in September. And Ray McGovern and I were discussing on this show the what everyone is jumping up and down now, which is the four-page memo done by the Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, that is right now a raging battle. And I just want to report that Ray McGovern said on this show, and I think columns he did in Consortium News and other places, that this is like a test case in the sense that this breaking open the relationship of the FBI, the CIA, Brennan, and others to the creating the lie that Russia hacked the DNC and that the Trump is a Manchurian puppet of Putin, that this is like a test case, that this breaking this open, which is going on right now, and the deep state is jumping up and down, and New York Times and all the other bullshit artists are jumping up and down. Stop, stop! Don't let this out, because, as King said, the moral arc of the universe is long and it bends towards justice. So if Mueller and the whole crowd behind what Binney and McGovern showed, Russia did not hack the DNC forensically, and now what's shown is that the British intelligence dossier of Mr. Christopher Steele, based on lies, is blowing up. That was used to get a FISA warrant. All of this is coming out. So my conclusion is to ask all of you to consider what blowing out the deep state liars, what the implications of this would be for 9/11 and other past crimes of these same individuals, because I think this all gives us a golden opportunity to really open up everything that's happened since the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, etc. And just got a note, Robert Mueller today asked for a 90-day postponement of General Michael Flynn. This just came out, I think, in the last hours, because there's a lot of tainted evidence here, and apparently even Mueller is feeling the heat right at this moment. So I'll stop there. The heat is on Mueller. The deep state is in deep doo-doo, and we should press on very confidently that we can take the deep state apart and there can be justice for all the people who've been victimized by these people over the years. Okay?
Okay. Yep, thank you. And we do have at least one person already in the queue to ask a question or make a comment, but folks, we're going to have to keep it pretty brief because we still have two more presentations.
Sure.
And our discussion of the evening. So let's move forward quickly as we can. And the first is Barbara Honegger. Make it quick, Barbara. Thank you.
Oh, hi. I didn't think I was first because I – can you hear me okay?
It turns out you
can hear you fine.
Okay, great. Just a couple of comments here. There's no question in any of our minds that Robert Mueller is almost certainly complicit in 9/11. He became the head of the FBI about 5 days before 9/11. He was one of the major cover-up artists, along with Chertoff and others. Okay, so there's no question about that. But we have to be extremely careful not to assume that because that is true and he and his organization, the special counsel's office, is investigating Trump, that makes Trump not complicit in what's being claimed about Trump. They can both be true. And just a comment on the four-page memo, I hope Devin Nunes releases that memo, the Republicans do, because it's going to backfire on them big time. And the reason it's going to backfire on them big time is because the Christopher Steele dossier that was put out by paid for by Fusion GPS. It was that research was originally funded by right-wing Republicans, number one. And number two, Carter Page, who is the focus of the Nunes Memorandum, Carter Page was being surveilled by the FBI, investigated by the FBI, tracked by the FBI for years, as far back as even 2014 or even 2012. And I'm going to send everybody on the list a very important analysis of what it takes to get a FISA warrant. The Christopher Steele dossier was by no means the only evidence that was used to get that FISA warrant. And not only that, that warrant was extended. Okay, those are my comments.
Okay. And I think that will wrap it up for this issue. Thank you for the presentation. Gerald,
okay. Thank you guys very much, and keep up your stellar work.
Okay, and that brings us to, whoops, hold on, I'll get it in just a minute here. That brings us to our major discussion for the evening. Wait a minute. I don't have the amended agenda here. I don't remember where I put you. Do you remember? Is it here? Oh, I'm sorry. You're not even unmuted, are you? It's right here. Yeah, so we're going to do Sanders. Okay. Moment. Okay. Xander,
all right, hello,
Xander. Okay, you're up. Okay, so
yep, I'll keep it brief. So I uploaded a master file to the list, and apparently it was too big for many of you to get. So I broke it up. I have just posted a smaller version of the PowerPoint, and the two video files that were embedded, I've separated out. Some of you may not be able to use them because of QuickTime. One of them is the other. You ought to be able to play. So I'm just going to run through the deal. The Las Vegas shooting October 1st was an atrocity. We've all heard lots of people report multiple shooters, et cetera, et cetera. There was one thread that was extremely interesting regarding aircraft over the area, helicopters in particular. It caught my attention, mostly because of my 9/11 research. And so I kind of keyed in on it and looked at it and found it to be credible. I went ahead and got membership to the Flight Radar 24 website. Adam myself, sure enough, they were very anomalous. And so I thought that I would approach McCarran Airport and the FAA with FOIA requests to ascertain the true nature of the helicopter in the vicinity. And that's basically what the presentation is about. So I'm just going to give you a summary. Three helicopters that use low decibel technology so that they can enter the Grand Canyon tours. They're C-130s. Off from McCarran, broadcasting Maverick helicopter registration numbers at about 9:45, and that's corroborated by traffic control audio as well as Flight Radar 24 data. These three helicopters turned in by day at about 9:50, meaning that they turned their transponders off. So we all know about transponders going off, right? The shooting breaks out a little after 10. All three of these helicopters reemerge on the radar, but one never returned to the airport. It has been in the air the entire time, and it basically clicks its transponder on at about 10:17. The air traffic control tower acknowledges this and says such with a voice of he says never before touched on radar. One of the video files that I have is all of the air traffic control audio, which I got from airtrafficcontrollive.net, along with our 24, it's linked to the second, and so you can download that and review very quickly what's going on with the aircraft and how you say it. The bottom line, my FOIA FAA, they denied a record of any of the aircraft, which was very peculiar, and they also alleged that they only keep records of aircraft that are in a radar environment and are being tracked by air traffic control under visual flight rules. So I did a little bit of homework. I read Title 14 of the Code of Federal Regulations, and I found numerous instances of violations of Title 14 in what the FAA was claiming and in the behavior of these helicopters. So there's been an appeal, and the appeal is referencing these issues. The FAA has acknowledged receipt of the appeal, and we're pending a response now. So it's kind of just a status update of what's going on. There's a lot of other avenues of investigation with respect to Las Vegas. One of the most recent bombshell things, the port in Rome, the alleged shooter, out of Steve and Paddock, so that's extra interesting. There's a lot of stuff with Vegas, but this one seems to have some evidentiary basis for that. It's not what we're being told. And there are FOIA requests. And truthfully, group, it's a little scary. You know, we're probably dealing not so much with the with governments, but my family, and who knows what. I don't know what I can explain to here, but that's an update. So I encourage you to download the presentation slides, review the video. Oh, there's one piece of footage that's important. of the airspace between Mandalay Bay and the Toronto Hotel that clearly showed some kind of aircraft activity at 10:08 p.m. local time. There's nothing in the air at 10:08, at least by transponder data. And so the FAA is going to have to explain what was in the air there making these signals, the white signatures. So, you know, at this point, I'm not ready to say whether people shot from helicopters, whether they were watching from helicopters, whether they were doing an exfiltration or an exfiltration, but the aircraft activity is certainly unusual, and we're spending a FAA on it. Now, because the deep state is falling apart, and, you know, we many people are now recognizing that Department of Justice is that the FBI cannot be trusted, potentially, and the kings of cover-up, this FOIA request has been copied to a lot of people. It's been copied to FAA IGs. It's been copied to Department of Defense IGs. It's been copied to Arizona Sheriff's Departments, Las Vegas Sheriff's Departments, Justice Attorney's Offices, police groups, judicial watch, keepers, and a number of entities to ensure that people, it's being paid attention to, because you know there's the Department of National Emergency and that is coinciding with the worst mass shooting atrocity in American history is cause for alarm. And the last slide in the presentation, so there will be a Vegas Truth event happening February 24th. So if any of you guys are West Coast or on a big trip to Sin City, you might be able to meet my wife. I think we're probably going to be there along with a bunch of other folks asking for accountability from the Sheriff's Department there in Las Vegas.
Okay. Thank you. Does anybody wish to make a quick comment or ask a quick question before we move on to our last item? Our second last item.
Yes, Barbara?
Yeah, Barbara.
Yeah, I'm unfortunate. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Xander, you cut in and out through the whole thing. Couldn't hear a word really to understand it. So hopefully the audio, did anybody else hear cutting out, in and out?
Yeah,
and hopefully the
sound quality was very poor, very poor.
Yeah, I just hope the audio, we may not be able to know what you said, Xander.
All right, can you hear me now?
No, it's still breaking up, Xander. You're picking up as you speak each time, so it's just, it has something to do with your telephone, apparently, or your location.
All right, that's a shame. I just took the mic that I was using off. You guys could interrupt me anytime. Okay, then next quick, I uploaded the presentation and without the video, and then I have two separate links, the embedded video. So I encourage all of you to download the presentation, read through it, and download the video. The video was really impressive, actually, as far as corroborating what's going on in the slides. But if not,
right.
Download the video.
So that's going to be that's available to people who are on the 9/11 conference listserv. If you're not on it, you'd like to be, just email me and we'll get you on it. Okay. Thank you, Xander. That was instructive and timely. So let's move on to our discussion for the evening. The long and the short of it is that I have taken on a lot more personal responsibility in my life and just simply do not have the time required to prepare agendas week after week, month after month, and play the deadline game and all that. It's just not in the cards for me right now. So I did a request a few years ago, if anybody were interested in doing this instead of me, they could still step forward. I've been doing it since. I've gotten some assistance from Cheryl, but it's not enough to release me from the time commitment that it's requiring to assemble this agenda week after month after month. And that's the same issue that I have that I need to be relieved of to some degree. I'm always willing to do the literal facilitation of teleconference if others can take up some of the rest of the work, including setting up maybe the monthly newsletter with the draft agendas and so forth. But in any case, it's to the pleasure of this group how we're going to proceed at this point. I simply cannot take the responsibility I have in being the focal point for agenda information from here on through. So it's open for discussion. Okay. Oh, so I'm sorry. Let me let's do Q&A mode again. Keep the Q&A mode, and then if you wish to make a comment or have a suggestion or want to volunteer to do something, do star 6, and you'll be in the queue. And at the end, we will open it up to make sure that everybody had a chance to, and anybody who's got technical issues with that will still have a chance to speak, okay, before we make any decisions. So, star 6, if you have some thoughts, okay? Okay, Xander, you're first.
Hey, Ken, sorry, I'm not going to be able to help take over or anything, but if you were to stay in a position and just needed additional help and coordinating or something, that might be something I could help with in the next round of comment.
Well, it must be a question of somebody serving as focal point for the agenda formation to receive and, compile agenda items and to be searching them out, because frankly, at one time there was kind of a group effort. We all sort of did outreach and tried to get speakers and stuff, and it sort of just fall on me and Cheryl. It just worked out. Yeah. So you're willing to help with that, is what you're saying, right? Is that right, Sandra?
Yeah, you know, helping to coordinate things, stuff like that. I don't think I with certainty couldn't participate on a regular enough basis to take on, like, organizing the call outright or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So you think once in a while you might be able to help, but you can't say when or how often, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I could, you know, help at least, come up with ideas for the calls,
Mm-hmm. Well, again, that was once upon a time everybody's responsibility. It's sort of narrowed down at this point to just a couple of people doing it. So, yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, if the call is going to continue, it's probably going to require everybody doing that again. But, okay, thank you, Xander. Let's go to Barry Stricker. Go ahead, Barry.
Yes, this is strictly a technical question. I do have hearing aids, but they're very high end. And normally I can hear well on the phone. I have a very high-end telephone here. And I find that the sound quality has really degraded. Gerald, I heard clearly. Barb, I could hear fairly clearly. I wonder, is anyone else having really serious sound problems where the signal is actually breaking up?
Well, yes, Barbara has mentioned this already, that apparently Xander's line is not working well for this purpose, and he himself only is breaking up very badly.
And right now, I'm actually, Gary, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm having trouble hearing you right now. Your voice is going in and out.
Oh,
same here. Okay. It's really gone to hell.
Mm.
Yeah.
The sound has gone to hell.
Wow. That is unfortunate, and that's something we probably need to be taking a look at too, is whether we want to stay with the conference call or go back to the other one with this issue. So something to think about, I guess. Okay, but let's try to stay in the question here of how we're going to proceed with, you know, reorganizing the workload here. I would like to make a comment or a question. I don't see anybody in the queue. Sure.
Well, I'm wondering, because it is a lot of work to do, and you've done a great job of it over the years, and you're very good about it, but you're very organized, timely with it. But I'm wondering if no one wants to kind of do what you do, at least with the agenda, et cetera, maybe we could divide it up and people take a month and they do it. And I don't know if that would get chaotic or not. I don't know, but...
Well, I think if we could find a regular rotation schedule of people who are willing to commit at least one month every so often, that could work. That would be a solution, I think.
But then, of course, the question is how do we communicate it to everyone who knows where they want to send their agenda item, you know, or book. I can always probably just forward, you know, to whoever the person is if we do it that way.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could do that, either you or designate someone else to take in the agenda items and see the person in charge that wants to get them, I guess.
Yeah.
So is anyone interested in taking on 1 month of, and Ken, you said you would still facilitate the call, so you're just looking for someone who will actually just do the agenda items and...
The minimum I'm looking for is someone to take the responsibility of, you know, doing the outreach and getting the agenda items organized. And, you know, if anybody who wants to learn the ropes of the MailChimp email, and actually do the newsletters, welcome to do that as well. You know, I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's a question of how much responsibility anybody's willing to take off our shoulders. I don't hear any volunteers other than Xander saying he would do that.
Well, Ken, I wouldn't mind taking on the agenda items, getting everything going, but I don't want to be the one to have to write it up for every month and do that because I just don't have the time to put into that. So if that's of any help to you, I don't know.
Well, if you could get it to the point where you had, you know, a couple sentence description of what the person wanted to talk about, an agenda, a title of their item, and the number of minutes they're requesting, I could take it from there. I think that much, okay. It's mm-hmm. just getting it to that point that is taxing me at this point, and I don't have time for it, okay?
Mm-hmm. And people on the call could just be aware that, you know, sometimes it is hard to get people to come on a speaker and, you know, keep it fresh and going so they have ideas or... you know, people that they think might be good to be on the call, let us know, you know.
Yeah, if I could just throw in here for a second, I think we've been a bit spoiled in the last maybe couple of years because there has been so much effort that's been put into finding guests.
David is an associate professor.
What was
that? It's going, Barbara.
It did. Anyway, you know, I think we've been a bit too passive in terms of our participation. We've kind of relied on Ken and Cheryl to find interesting guests for the call in order to make it an attractive thing for people to come to. But maybe, you know, before it used to just simply be the participants put things on the agenda that they wanted to bring up for discussion. And if we didn't have much, then we, you know, we didn't have much, and we had a discussion, an open discussion or something, which is not the ideal, obviously. You don't want to have ideally nothing on the agenda, but maybe we all need to be a little more, we need to take more of an active role just in proposing items and, you know, in both guests to come and maybe to put things on ourselves that we might want to talk about, you know, and not sort of put it all in the facilitator's lap to get all the guests. You know, maybe we've kind of gotten into that habit a little too much. So I just want to throw that out there.
Thank you for that. Okay. Lynn Bradbury wants to join the conversation. Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, Ken. I'd like to thank you for being such an even-handed, perceptive, empathetic moderator for all the time. I mean, I'm relatively new. I don't even know when this started. Do you know?
Well, I started doing this around 7 years ago. The actual call started at least a year or two prior to that by Jonathan Mark, okay?
All right. And you started it when? It broke up and I didn't hear.
About 7 years ago or so, I think, roughly. 6 or 7 years ago.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, it is.
So, on the whole, have you since you've done it, you've searched for, you've come up with the agenda, and like what, a 10% suggestion rate from the rest of us or less?
That's a fair estimate. Until she came along, and Cheryl has been pitching in, trying to help get folks on. But
so if we all brainstormed just on our own and sent in suggestions to whom?
Wait, but I don't want to be the one that gets suggestions.
I understand that.
I don't mind that. I won't mind being the one getting suggestions.
Yeah, okay, so if Cheryl could be the point person and we can all work a little harder to try to do a little outreach or find ideas for the call, and Cheryl could put it together in terms of, you know, having it ready for email. I could do the email and continue to use the facilitation of the call. I could do that much, but that's about as far as I can go at this point.
All right. Well, okay. I'll try to think of things like that, people and topics, because I'm not interested at all or capable, of anything technical.
But to keep the burden off of Cheryl, see, the thing to do once you get the idea is to reach out to the person that you have in mind and see if they're interested.
Try to contact them.
Yeah, do the contacting yourself, at least the initial one, you know, until determine whether or not they're interested. And if they are, then spend it with Cheryl. Say, look, this guy says this woman or whatever says come on the teleconference, and here's the contact info, and then she can take it from there, I think. That's fair enough. But ask her to start from scratch with somebody's, scratching their head idea, I don't think that's fair. It's kind of a little bit of that.
Do you think that when we have an initial idea, it should only go to one person, or should it sort of be put out there for other people even as we think of them?
Well, there's nothing, if you're on the listserv, you can always run it by the listserv to get feedback and say, well, how do I feel about me contacting so-and-so to be on the next call, and if you want that feedback. But I think you should feel free to take initiative if you're quite clear that it's pertinent to our teleconference, and then give it to Cheryl, who can make the final determination and do the setting up of, with the person, okay?
Yeah, all right. I think that's a good idea. We should all be doing it more. And I will try.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Ken, would it be a good idea for this to be maybe mentioned on each call, maybe near the end, maybe just to say, does anyone have any suggestions for future agenda items? We've
good.
Done that a couple, here and there, and somebody has taken on the commitment to call someone.
Right. Okay. Well, anybody can do that. Anybody should do that. You can do it as well as I can, Craig, and I think it should be done. But the point is not to just come up with the idea and leave it there because it sounds like a good idea, but to take the idea and run with it and do some of the work and then bring it back to the point person for resolution and agendizing. Okay.
But what I'm suggesting is that if we bring it up on the call, then we can decide right then and there who's going to make, in other words, the person suggesting it can say, I don't have any contact for this person, and somebody else could jump in and say, well, I'll call them.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. You're suggesting making a call the place where we're in, which we sort of do committee work to set up the next call to the extent that we can. And that seems to me to make some sense. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. A week or two ago, you put a suggestion and a query out how many of us would be willing to read and buy the $30 book by Lauren Guillon. And I mean, it sounded fascinating, and I listened to the interview. It is hard to commit to that, a purchase like that. But were you thinking of discussing that on a program or in the emails?
I was thinking of setting up a book on the teleconference. That would be our sort of focus for a teleconference or two. And if enough people had been willing to commit, which they were not, I would think about trying to get Guillaume himself to join us at some point. Although, of course, his being in Europe makes that kind of, difficult.
But thank you for alerting us to the book, and I haven't forgotten about it. I'm sorry I didn't answer you.
Well, I think it's right up our alley. I don't I can't imagine a more than book for us to be reading, but there wasn't much response to it, and that's another reason I'm feeling a bit dismayed about my role here. So.
Probably feeling discouraged.
Yeah, I admit it freely.
Well, thank you for all that you've done.
Well, thanks. Appreciate it. Okay, so it sounds like our plan going forward is Cheryl becomes one person for agenda, for resolving agenda questions, which is to say what is going to go on the agenda. But she's not going to be charged for doing all the work of coming up with ideas and contacting people. That's what we're going to share, and we will use the teleconference needed to make sure that we have something to look forward to on the next teleconference. So that will be one of the agenda items in future teleconferences, unless we have full agenda. If we start getting real full agendas and, you know, Cheryl doesn't know what to do with everything, then skip it. But otherwise, we're going to probably need to be doing that if we want to continue to have a teleconference. So if that's all right, everybody, let me open up the mic here and make sure that we're okay with this.
Yeah, and just I think for February we correct, and we don't have anyone for February on the agenda at this point.
No, I do not. We have nothing.
Okay.
Can you hear me? It's Barb. I have a suggestion.
Go ahead, Barb.
Oh, good. I can be heard again. Okay. Thank you. At the JFK conference where I went with Bonnie Faulkner and Jane Clark, who's the president of the 9/11 Attorneys Group, and I do want to give, unless somebody else, Cheryl is on the call, who can give an update on the grand jury petition of the lawyers group, I could do that in the next segment really quick.
Okay.
But I met someone at the JFK conference who told me 2 days ago he's willing to be on the call. I really think it would be an incredible segment. And his, mm-hmm. I don't know how many people know this person. His name is Gordon Headley Ferry. He speaks at JFK conferences, but what's important for our teleconference is that he personally worked with Dov Zakheim, I believe, for 2 decades.
Uh-huh.
And he has seen behind the smoke curtain and is particularly focused on the Who Did It section at the mm-hmm. end, which I would recommend people review. It's my best ability to say, but he's looked at it and he said, my God, I believe you're right. And he wants to tell us why he believes Dov Zakheim was critically involved.
Wow. Yes. That would make a great February teleconference if you
Barbara. Oh. All right. So what I will do, this is a perfect example. I think, I don't remember who suggested it, but on our at the end or towards the end of every teleconference, I think we should have a segment that's set aside in the agenda, a regular segment, where people can propose ideas like this so that we can get people's feedback on the call.
That's what we're considering right now. That's the proposal on the table, Barbara. So,
okay. Does everybody think that's a good idea for me to pursue? If so, I'll get back to Cheryl after getting to Gordon Ferry.
Definitely.
Objecting, but are there any objections? Nope. Doesn't sound like it. Sounds like everybody's gung ho with the idea.
Yeah, and if I can just say, Barbara was talking to me about having Mick Harrison, is that his first name, come on the call this time. And Barbara, I tried contacting him, but he never got back to me. So maybe for next month,
right.
That's also a possibility. So.
Well, yes, of course, it's a possibility, but I'm going to leave that with you because I shouldn't be the middle person on that.
Okay.
When we get to the update on the 9/11 attorneys group, which I can give you, I'm a member of that group, I can fill you in on that. But it's just because he's so terribly busy working on the grand jury petition.
Yeah.
Can you give us that tonight, you mean?
Yes, yes, that's on the agenda later.
Good.
Huh? What?
What?
What did you say, Barbara?
The announcements at the end always includes an update on the
Okay, got it. Okay, I misunderstood. I thought you said it had been agenda. Okay.
Well, it's in the agenda announcements regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So it sounds like we have a potential plan here. We'll have to just see how it works. It seems to be working at the moment because by using this method, we've got this idea on the table that Barbara's going to pursue, and hopefully we'll have something to look forward to next time as she gets that information to Cheryl, and Cheryl gets it to me by, in time enough to get out the draft agenda. So we'll try to work with this and see how it goes. And if it doesn't work, go ahead.
This is Lynn. I have another question. I would be interested to see how the whole thing began. I mean, just a short encapsulation of what was the purpose of it. And, I mean, not
the original.
Yeah, because in some ways, I suppose, not that we look at it as entertainment, but looking to be, have input given to us rather than having it be a discussion of other ideas, from everybody, which I guess are perfectly welcome, but not usually happening so much.
So I'm not understanding what you're asking at this point. What is it that you would like?
I'd like to just see how, understand what brought it about, the whole teleconference, how it first evolved, and
okay, great.
If we're living
quickly
up to that.
We're really running short on time, but here's the long and the short. Okay, Janice Matthews once upon a time used to have a monthly teleconference. Okay. And it was really good because she would occasionally have on people, as we do, interesting guests that would be very informative and help move us understanding forward. But at one point, quite a while back actually now, she decided to throw the towel on it, okay, and just drop that. Okay. So that was happening on the one side. And on the other side, Jonathan Mark started this teleconference around the same time, and this one was to allow leaders of local groups to get together and talk about what's going on in their particular
area,
so to speak, areas, and to share information across, and also to look in particular for strategies around which the movement could unite that would help move the 9/11 to move forward. Okay, so one of the major topics of discussion for quite a while is the misprision of treason approach that was thought about for New York. And then the next major topic was the 9/11 CC with Gravel until he ran off with our money. Okay, so those were the kinds of things that we were focusing on, was things, strategies, basically strategies for moving the 9/11 to moving forward. That seem to have legs, okay.
To share with, yeah.
Well, not to right. share, but to unite around, okay, to unite action around. They would act more of an action focus in the first place rather than a discussion focus. Okay? But it was more of a discussion focus rather than an action focus. So those were the two different problems. They both just sort of ended up in this, okay? So kind of both are there, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think we're ready for Wayne's little at the end here. So Wayne, you want to go ahead and do that real quick, and then we'll move on to announcements.
Yeah, I'm gonna do it as quick as I can.
Thank you.
The weekend of January 12th, there was a conference with a couple hundred people, Coalition Against U.S. Foreign Military Coalition Against U.S. Foreign Military Bases. The website is noforeignbases.org. It was put on by 13 different groups that ranging from Code Pink to the Black Alliance for Peace and a whole bunch of other people. The point was to basically go over the cost of military bases, the environmental damage that they do, the fact that they flout laws, to review the enormous level of protests against various aspects of these bases, whether it's the legacy pollution that they've caused, leaving blown up or unexploded munitions, buried Agent Orange, stuff like that. And to review some of the protests that are ongoing around the world that were just really kind of astonishing to me. But it was a really fascinating event. And if you go to the website, noforeignbases.org, you can see that there is at the very beginning, at the very top, there's a kind of a picture of their logo. But it is, in fact, a link to a YouTube. And there's a whole series of videos on YouTube documenting the different plenary sessions. And I encourage you all to go take a look at some of these. David Byrne is kind of, he does the lead in one that you'll see in the at the top of the page. Talks about the how many bases there are, where they are, kind of what they cost, and a lot of other basic information. I don't need to say much more about it than it's a very worthwhile place to go. If you want to see the deep state's military arm, well, it's in almost all these countries, and a lot of people are struggling to fight against them. There's going to be a follow-on conference in Ireland probably around October. That is the problem with holding a conference here in the United States is people from Cuba can't come here. People from North Korea can't come. They can probably get to Ireland. And so we can have a world conference talking about how to tame this multi-headed $150 billion a year process. So I guess with that, I'll end. I can answer a question or two if there's any, but maybe we can make a better presentation at on a later teleconference. Over.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne. Any comments or questions on Wayne's presentation on that topic? You can just speak out because nobody's muted right now if you want to say anything.
I think.
Go ahead.
This is Lynn. I think it's very valuable to join whenever we can with Veterans for Peace and like Wayne's website that features Coalition for Peace and Justice. I just think that's very fruitful for gaining new allies.
I'll just simply say on the February 23rd, there's a call to have a protest against not just Guantanamo, the military prison, but to shut down the naval base and return to the Cubans, and that's one of the many resolutions, or one of the resolutions that was voted on and approved, and is in their term. Over. I'm done. Thanks.
So, what date was that when?
February 23rd. If you go to hopeoutloud.org, without the Pentagon, just hopeoutloud.org, you'll see some of the information and the link to the national, some of the national information.
Okay.
Wayne, I'm at your website, and most of the things that I press on, I'm at the page that talks about the cost of the war on terror, and all the links to the left, there's only about one that doesn't lead to something written in Chinese, and then it, like all Chinese writing, except for it says 404 error, so I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but anyway. I just wonder if all of those are live links in your list there, because they don't seem to be.
Go ahead.
We don't need to talk about it now, but you might want to check them yourself.
On the right-hand side?
No, on the left where it says links, calendar.
Oh, you're on the legacy site, aren't you?
I don't know. It just says hopeoutloud.org.
And it's got one single big blue banner with a yellow Hope Out Loud.
And under it says contents, and then home, billboard for truth, calendar page, et cetera. And only one or two of those things actually lead anywhere.
You have to do a refresh of your page, because you have a very old version on your computer.
Okay. Well, I went to it from start page. Anyway, I don't need to talk about it now.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you might not be able to do it from a proxy, Lynn. It might be the issue.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Wayne. And so we are now open for announcements. So who has an announcement? If you have one, just say it because everybody's unmuted right now.
Okay, I do, Barb, on the legal end of things.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, just really in a nutshell, everybody, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, which is 35 to 40 attorneys and some researchers, I'm one of the five researchers with that group, they, as you know, put on a year ago, September, not this past September, they put on the Truth and Justice event in New York City. And since then, it was voted on at that event. It's called Justice in Focus back in September of 2016 in New York City. And the Lawyers Committee at the very end of that conference voted to pursue a grand jury, a call for a special criminal grand jury, or frankly any kind of grand jury that would have to be a criminal grand jury, for the events of 9/11. Now, the group has divided it. It's been very, very active behind the scenes. You haven't heard anything because of all the work we've been doing and how difficult and detailed it is. But the decision has been made to have the first petition demanding a special criminal grand jury, or to have a sitting criminal grand jury in the Southern District, Federal Court for the Southern District of New York, which is in Manhattan, to either take the information that we've pulled together. It's called a grand jury petition with a huge number of very, very hard, forensically hard attachments, exhibits, evidentiary exhibits, to call for either a sitting criminal grand jury to receive those, or to have the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York Federal Court submit it, call for a new special criminal grand jury. Now, the decision was made to focus only on the World Trade Center at the beginning, and that's what we've done. This work has been going on for over about a year and a half, a little bit less now. And I've been intimately involved with the research and the documents with Richard Gage and a small number of people in what's called the Grand Jury Petition Research and Drafting Committee. And I just want you to know that it is a magnificent document, which will be on the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry website as soon as it is filed. It was going to be filed today, but it had to be delayed. I can't tell you why it's delayed, but it's delayed for a very good reason that will make it even stronger. So it's important that it wasn't filed today, that we're waiting to try to get what we want. And if we do, I would expect it would be a guess, though, that it will be filed sometime in February and before our next teleconference. That would be a very 90% guess on my part. And if so, I know that Cheryl will do her best to try to get Mick Harrison, who's the main drafter of it, with the input from people from the entire 9/11 truth movement. Mick Harrison has gone out of his way to get input through this document, gone to New York in particular and met with all of the leaders and activists in the 9/11 truth community in New York City for inputs to the document over the past year. And there was a very good turnout for that. So anyway, this is coming up in the near future. So I will just keep Cheryl posted, as I promised to do. I will know when the next projected filing date is. Once it is filed, it will be physically filed by Mick Harrison and perhaps others. We'll walk into the U.S. Attorney's Office to the grand jury. To the U.S. Attorney's Office in Federal Courthouse in the Southern District of New York when this happens. And then there will be a public press conference on the steps of that federal courthouse in New York City on in Foley Square, called FOLEY Square, where we held our big event for 9/11 Truth Worldwide just this past September, same place, Foley Square. And there will be a big press conference at 10 or 11 in the morning, as was planned for actually this morning, but it's been postponed. So I will keep everybody up to date on the timing of this. And there is a media committee. There are drafts of press releases. There are drafts of special articles that will go out to op-ed news and other places. Those are being prepared. Lots of input, editorial input is coming into those. So the sooner we can know, with a more advanced notice as we can get, as to when this is going to actually happen this time, all the more better for everybody to get the word out widely. Okay?
Barbara,
so,
can I ask you a question?
Oh, go ahead. Yes, sure.
Barbara, does the grand jury petition include Leroy Halsey's final report?
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you. It cuts in and out. Maybe
yes,
somebody...
Yes, did it include Leroy Halsey's report, final report?
Well, question. Just forgive my ignorance, but has Leroy Halsey put out his final report? I thought he put out his so-called final draft, but not the final report. Am I wrong about that?
My understanding.
Well, I haven't heard anything about Leroy Halsey presenting his final report. I was wondering if the special information that you had included his final report.
Well, I'm trying to answer you. I don't believe he's completed his final report yet. So I can't answer that question.
Yep.
But I will look into it and have the answer. I don't believe so, because the final report, I don't believe, has been completed. That's my answer.
Okay. Barbara, I had a question on why was it postponed today? Do you know, was it from the, you know, court side or from your side?
Exactly. No. As I said, I can't give you the details. That wouldn't be right. But
I don't know if it's from within the committee or from...
Yes, I do. Yes. I've said already, it's on our side to make it even stronger.
Okay,
good.
Yes. And believe me, it would be worth waiting for it if we can get it.
And
absolutely, yeah.
Is Daniel Sheehan still consulting and advising on it?
He is, and it's one of the reasons that for the delay that we haven't heard back from him yet. But I really don't want to say anymore. I really shouldn't say anymore.
We don't really want you to have to feel under pressure to do that, Barbara. That wouldn't be fair to your committee. So I want to say that I hope we can get on the call, but whether we do or not, Barbara is an insider with this, so she's very good about giving us what she's allowed to talk about, and I think we'll be okay with that. Barbara will just continue to keep us updated, okay?
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that. I'll do it through Cheryl even before the next call. And I just want everybody to know that this is just about World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7, and everyone will be extremely pleased with what the committee has done, what the lawyers committee has done, what the grand jury petition drafting research committee has done, and in particular, the magnificent way that Nick Harrison, with all of his legal writing expertise, that he has put it together as a truly solid legal document with all of the exhibits.
See, and the reason why we have not heard anything is because the lawyers have been so busy. They've been so busy getting this thing together that they really haven't had time to do outreach, okay? And that's the bottom line. And I know that my involvement with it on the website level, okay? So that's just the way it is, folks. We have to be patient, but they are doing what they need to do, and it's going to happen at some point, okay?
Well, yeah, it's better to do it right and better to do it as well as we can and right than do it more quickly. So I would expect this to happen in February.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara.
Yeah, keep us up to date as to when the dates are, if people can be there, and also if the media committee needs help, if there's anything you can do to help us hasten it along. And I don't know if there's any compulsion on the New York Times and Washington Post to actually print it if you give it to them.
No, of course not. But the good news is that many people don't really understand that the mainstream media, one of our big problems with the mainstream media is that the mainstream media is a quasi-official, if not an official media. I mean, and by official, what I mean is legally, they can cover their you-know-what legally. If they report on official actions, whether they are executive branch actions or court actions, and especially court filings and court actions, these are official documents, and they can just report on them without taking a position on the content. Okay. So the very fact that, we're doing something officially makes it more likely that mainstream media like the New York Times will report on it. But, you know, we'll see. We'll do our best.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Any other announcements before we close tonight?
I do know that Sander Hicks, it's Barb, I do know that Sander Hicks has contacted me yesterday and today and his people. He's starting on a tour, I believe, on the 2nd of February, going around the United States, and then he will in March be, I believe, with Kevin Barrett at a conference that they have every year in Tehran, Iran. So Sander Hicks is looking for people to put on events for him. He's running for Congress again on a 9/11 platform, amongst others, and he's going around the country to educate people about 9/11 and raise funds for his campaign. So anybody who would like to put on an event for him, please get in touch with him as soon as possible.
Okay. Any other announcements? Well, hearing none, thank you. I'm sorry?
Can I ask Barbara another question?
Sure.
Yeah, quick, please. Go ahead.
Okay. Barbara, are you aware of where Justice Imposimato is at with his submission to the International Criminal Court? Is that moving ahead?
No. That was rejected many, many years ago. And the reason is, unfortunately, apparently you don't know this, but the reason is that he, there was a lot of noise there. My understanding of the reason is that the International Criminal Court's jurisdiction only begins for events that started in 2002 or after. That's my understanding. But the bottom line is, no, it has not gone anywhere. And for those who don't know, unfortunately for all of us, Judge Imposimato passed away recently. And there is going to be a very, very wonderful article that Jane Clark and myself and Adam Buckley, who is the founder of the Rome 9/11 Truth Group and was a close colleague and translator for the judge. A number of us have inputted, at the request of Richard Gage, for an article on Judge Imposimato, which is in the final draft form. It's been submitted to Richard and the people there at A&E, and it will pretty soon, if it isn't already, be posted on the Architects and Engineers website.
Great.
Okay. Yep. Thank you. And any other announcements? If there are not, I want to thank everyone for their cooperation, their good ideas, and hopefully the energy they're going to put in the future to outreach good inputters for our teleconference. So thank you again, and we'll see you the last Wednesday of March for the next one.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Bye.